Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 2:36 p.m. It's Wednesday, February 8, 2017. Before we begin, I would like to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, and Summers Cole from the Juno LIO, who make sure we have sound and a transcript of our committee hearings. At this time, I want to remind everyone, including committee members and all those in the room, to please silence your cell phones. Present with us today are Representative Kopp, Representative Christ Tompkins, my Vice Chair, Representative Fansler, and myself, Representative Clayman. I will also note for the record that Representative Millett was recently appointed by the Committee on Committees to the House Judiciary Committee as a second alternate. We do have a quorum for doing business. Before we get into the regular affairs of the committee, I do want to note for committee members and anyone else in the public that might be interested that the Alaska Supreme Court will actually be holding oral arguments tomorrow morning and afternoon at the Diamond Courthouse right across the street. Members might be interested in attending. The calendar is posted online, but I see four cases that are listed, one at 9 in the morning, John Gregory Lane versus the City and Borough of Juneau. I'd note all these are cases relating to Southeast and Southeast attorneys. The second case at 9:45 a.m. is Douglas Indian Association versus Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes. The third case at 10:30 a.m. is Anthony Zank and Ruth Baumgartner versus the City and Borough of Juneau. And the last case scheduled for 1:30 p.m. is Bill Yankee versus City and Borough of Juneau. If I can manage time in my schedule, I will go watch these oral arguments because maybe it's because I'm sometimes overly fascinated with the judicial process, but I always find it interesting, the questions that get asked, and I think it's a real civic education just to watch how the court operates in live and not just in written form. And if you have questions, you can certainly contact my office. Our first order of business today is correcting an error regarding House Concurrent Resolution 1. At the time we moved the bill out of committee, the sponsor's office had not provided the fiscal note. The sponsored office has now provided the fiscal note for HCR 1, which committee members have in front of them. In order for the bill to move to the next committee of referral, we will proceed by rescinding the previous motion, adopting the fiscal note, and then moving the bill back out of committee. We will now rescind the motion to move House Concurrent Resolution 1 out of committee. May I have a motion?
Yes, I move to rescind our previous motion to move House Concurrent Resolution 1 out of committee.
Is there any objection to moving it out of committee? Hearing and seeing none, the motion carries. And all members should have the fiscal note in front of you. May I have a motion to adopt the fiscal note that's before us?
I move to adopt the zero fiscal note before us and attach the fiscal note to House Concurrent Resolution 1.
And before I meant to note, while we've been busy going through, I see Representative Eastman has joined us, as well as Representative Reinbold. Is there any objection to attaching the fiscal note to House Concurrent Resolution 1? Hearing and seeing no objection, that motion also carries. Now that House Concurrent Resolution has the proper fiscal note, may I have a motion to move House Concurrent Resolution 1 out of committee?
I move House Concurrent Resolution 1, version 30-LS0209J, from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection?
Subject to get one thing on record.
Sure, go ahead. We'll go ahead. Yes, state your objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, we accidentally did the amendment to the wrong bill. It was to HCR 1 last Friday in committee, and so it was the two-thirds was supposed to be actually to the HCR 1. So just wanted to get that on record. Instead of the majority, it was two-thirds of the majority of the full House. The amendment that was done to the conflict of interest bill instead of HCR 1, that amendment was supposed to be on HCR 1.
Oh, I see. Okay, but in terms of the fiscal note, you don't have any problem?
Correct.
Okay, so I appreciate your clarifying that confusion.
we were dealing with the motion to move the bill, and I objected to get that on the record.
Okay. And you then would remove your objection now?
I do remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
And is there any other objection to moving House Concurrent Resolution 1 out of committee? Hearing and seeing none, then that report will move on, and we will take do we need to sign the forms again? Okay. So actually, we won't take a brief at ease. We'll let the signing thing take go. We can sign it as we go forward with the rest of the hearing today. Our next order of business is House Bill 8, Enforcement of Foreign Protective Orders, sponsored by Representative Edgemont. This is the first hearing on the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Tim Clark, staff to Representative Edgemont. Mr. Clark, would you please come forward to the table, identify yourself for the record, and begin your presentation. And I will note for the committee, my plan is that we will not move this bill today. We'll hear the bill, and hopefully we will hear this again on Monday, with the goal on Monday to move it out of committee. And Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Edgemont, the bill sponsor. HB 8 essentially will put Alaska statute in line with federal law that supersedes some existing contradictions. In 2014, the elimination of what was known as the Alaska exemption from the Federal Violence Against Women Act brought attention to the state's obligation to enforce protection orders from other jurisdictions.
Just a moment. I don't think – I can't remember if I recognize that Representative Ledoux has joined us. But if I didn't, I apologize for not doing that right away. Sorry, and go ahead.
Those other jurisdictions include other state, territorial, or tribal courts. Under existing statute law, state law enforcement is only compelled to enforce a tribal or other state's protection order if it has been filed with a clerk in an Alaskan court. However, with Alaska now subject to the Violence Against Women Act, the filing or registration of those protection orders is not necessary for them to be enforced. HB 8 follows the recommendation of the Department of Law to amend conflicting statutes in order to bring Alaska into compliance with the federal law. It will not only clarify the duties of state law enforcement, but also eliminate a potential risk of lawsuits that could stem from the contradictions currently in statute and also possible complications in prosecutions. The bill also adds a presumption of validity on the part of state law enforcement so that they are encouraged to enforce a protective order issued in another jurisdiction so long as it appears authentic on its face. That could be construed as a sort of erring on the side of caution, you know, when it comes to a situation where someone might be in danger. And it also more clearly specifies in statute that other states and other jurisdictions include courts of another state or territory, United States military tribunals, and tribal courts. One thing we do like to mention when the bill comes up is that the Department of Law continues to encourage registration of protection orders from other jurisdictions. The Attorney General noted in his opinion that the State Central Registry gives officers access to tribal and foreign protection orders anywhere in Alaska, even if the victim does not have a copy of the order at hand. So, and with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to take any questions.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
Having been someone who enforced these orders for more than two decades, I have a couple questions. First, I want to thank the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. It does reconcile Alaska law with federal law. Question Sir, is there anything in the bill that deals with child custody orders, or is this just domestic violence protection orders?
Representative Kopp, through the chair, the bill's various sections go into almost all relevant parts of state law that where a protection order could or the current or even previous existence of a protection order could bear on decision making. And I believe, for example, the first section, the section 4 of the bill relates to the state child fatality review team, and there are certain instances where to jump to the sectional where this is put a little bit more succinctly than the bill, it addresses statutes related to the requirements that the child fatality review team reviews a report of a death of or when it reviews a report, you know, of the death of a child, or if anyone in the child's immediate household was a petitioner or a respondent to a protection order within the previous year, that has to sort of play a part in their deliberations. But you were speaking more in terms of child custody considerations?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So I think one of the things, just to remember that this legislation, while it reconciles VAWA with state statute, it has to do with protection orders, which are issued by what I think you and I would consider all levels of the judiciary, everything from a magistrate who may not even be a lawyer, no legal training in the law required, all the way up to a Superior Court judge. And in my experience, one of the things, particularly when you get into child custody, where you have maybe a mother and a child that's in Alaska and doesn't want to go back to, in fact, I've had that personal experience where they don't want to go back to an abusive situation, and then you talk with the court that issued it, and I remember feeling like this is not the judicial timber that we're dealing with up here in Alaska. And that's why I specifically, I think protection orders are great. Protection orders are very more limited, more narrow in scope, and so I get into the child custody things just to address those situations where people may in fact be leaving a very abusive situation and a court order following them up here telling them that they have to come back and bring the kid with them. And in that case, you kind of want the state to be able to really examine that carefully before jumping in. I don't know if this bill gets in it. I did not read it word for word. I certainly support it conceptually. But I just would like to maybe know for sure if we're getting into child custody issues or not.
Representative Kopp, through the chair, I have to defer to the Department of Law on that question. I'm not certain that the sort of court order that you're referring to is necessarily a protection order.
So I think that the person that would best be able to answer that is Mary Lindquist, the senior attorney general that's involved with this, who's on the line from Fairbanks. Ms. Lindquist, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Did you hear Representative Kopp's question?
Yes.
Can you answer that question?
Representative Kopp, through the chair, protection orders govern certain child custody orders, and but only with respect to their domestic violence protection aspect. So a protection order can have a child custody component to it, but I think that what you were addressing was something separate with a true child custody order, and I don't think this bill would cover the type of order that you were contemplating.
Representative Kopp, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I I guess it just, I think it's important for the committee to just to know that these types of protection orders are issued by certainly for good reasons, but by not the same maybe standard of training that we would expect across the board. And I think protection orders, we should always default on the side of you know, protecting people who are in harm's way. But I appreciate the answer on child custody, that it does not appear that this is addressing that. Those issues are certainly more volatile, and I personally have been in conversations with our governor's office on cases where I did not think the Department of Law should enforce an out-of-state one that had to do with a family fleeing a very violent situation and a judge. This was not a tribal case, by the way. It was saying, though, they needed to reappear in front of their court, and that mother and child did go back, and it ended up ending very badly for both of them and caused a little conflict with us and the previous governor. But so it's just something of our committee needs to be aware of, that on these protection orders, that we know what all it covers. And I think domestic violence protection orders, we do want to be consistent with federal statute, and we also want to know all the situations that it may in fact cover. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Do you have anything to add to that, what the Attorney General had, or?
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, go ahead.
It may be helpful to Representative Kopp that protection order, you know, as defined in the Violence Against Women Act, can be found in Section 204, Paragraph 5 of the Act, where it states that a protection order means any injunction, restraining order, or other order issued by a civil or criminal court for the purpose of preventing violence or threatening acts or harassment against, sexual violence against, contact or communication with or physical proximity to another person, and includes any temporary or final order issued by a civil or criminal court, whether obtained by filing an independent action or as a pendant lite order in another proceeding, if the similar civil or criminal order was issued in response to a complaint, petition, or motion filed by or on behalf of a person seeking protection. So I think if I understand what you've described through the chair, Representative Kopp, it's a narrower definition in this.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with, I do believe it is narrower, and I appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
And I'll just, any other questions or comments? Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Yes, through the chair. Could you just briefly summarize, now currently in statute we have recognition and enforcement of protective orders from other states, and what, you know, someone who was brand new coming to this bill might think that we were creating that for the first time, but since that is already in the statute, what is the main difference, I suppose, in how that's enforced and carried out now as opposed to what would happen under this bill?
Thank you, Representative Eastman, through the chair. The main thing the bill accomplishes is to reconcile the part of statute that currently requires a protection order issued in another jurisdiction to be registered with the state court before it would be reinforced. So I think the intent of VAWA and the intent of reconciling these statutes is a sort of streamlining effort, so that if someone were, say, being menaced by someone against whom they had a protection order out, they could get immediate help from law enforcement, even if they had not yet taken the time or were aware that their order in hand should have been registered with the state.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead, Representative Eastman.
On a slightly different topic, I can think of, you know, situations when protective orders are filed with good reason and then perhaps with less good reason a reciprocity is filed against the person who filed the protective orders. Now you've got protective orders going both ways. Is there any kind of safety measure here so that if there's, you know, a state out there with less than ideal laws, that we don't find ourselves enforcing something that is just really not a good idea, I guess? Because it would seem to me the assumption can go to a perceived victim who's filing a protective order, but then if you have, you know, orders going both ways and the perpetrator is filing the protective order, I don't want to see Alaskans hemmed up because of that.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Clark, is that something you want to hand off to the Assistant Attorney General, or is that something you want to take on?
Mr. Chairman, I'll attempt to answer that with what I hope is a substantive answer, and invite the Assistant Attorney General to add anything to it she believes would be helpful. But Representative Eastman, through the chair, I think you might be referring to, say, a protection order that could be construed as frivolous or unjust in some way. But there is criteria specifically in Section 2265 of the Violence Against Women Act that specifies certain criteria protection orders from other jurisdictions must meet. The issuing court must have jurisdiction in the parties and the matter under the laws of the state, territory, or tribe, and the issuing court must give reasonable notice and opportunity to the person against whom that order is sought in order for that person's due process to be protected. I think that goes a long way toward eliminating the possibility of frivolousness, but I would, you know, allow Mary Lindquist or encourage her to add to that if she sees fit. So.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I would just add to that the protection order has to appear valid on its face for the law enforcement personnel to enforce it. And in addition to the protection that it has to be a consistent order, that there's, you know, the tribe or whatever the issuing entity was, that it had to have jurisdiction and due process. Although we don't look at those issues up front, the person against whom the proceeding is, you know, the violation of the protection order is being brought, they have an opportunity to object in court as to whether there was jurisdiction in the issuing court, personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, whether they were given due process. So there will be a ready opportunity to challenge a protection order once it's in court.
Representative
Eastman. Follow-up through the chair. Thank you very much. I'm curious to know if what sort of analysis have we done recent times about what how laws differ in those other states. I'm trying to find out if I can identify perhaps the most restrictive example of a state and its dealing with protective orders, and then try and get a better handle on how that might apply to Alaskans, particularly in a case where it was frivolous, but I understand that courts aren't always able to make that determination immediately, and often the tie does go to someone who's filing for an order, and then some of the details get sorted out later. I'm just curious to know what analysis has been done of other states, and are there any outliers of states that handle these, you know, in a particularly extreme way? Thank you.
Mr. Clark, is that one you want to try, or do you want to see whether Ms. Lindquist has it?
Mr. Chairman, I will punt immediately to the Assistant Attorney General on that.
Ms. Lindquist. Go ahead.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, the Violence Against Women Act requires the state to enforce a protection order as if it was an order of the enforcing state. So we would have to enforce the protection order just as if it was a state order, and that would include in the state of Alaska arrest for violation of the protection order. We have not done an in-depth review of other states' protection order statutes, and the reason for that really, I think, is that the state of Alaska is required to enforce protection orders from other states, from other tribes, under the limits of set under VAWA.
And I would just note as a bit of a follow-up, this is not exactly the same, but it's very related to the full faith and credit provisions in the U.S. Constitution that recognize that our job in Alaska is not to come in and say California or Louisiana or Texas or New York has entered an order finding somebody to be taking whatever they do in those states for domestic violence. It's not our job to go back and second guess what that court did. Our job is to treat that as a valid judgment of that particular jurisdiction. Representative Eastman, I would note it's just a little bit after 3. I'm comfortable pushing on for maybe 10 or 15 minutes if the whole committee has got the time and availability. If people feel a need to wind up, we can stop sooner. I'm looking around to see if anybody has a problem continuing a little bit. Okay. I had Representative Reinbold next, and then I've got Representative Kopp and Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Through the chair, I know that this is not the last hearing on the bill, but I have a couple questions. First of all, I see that there are several things in brackets in the bill, which means we're deleting them. And we're deleting filed in court in several places in the bill, and it's being replaced often with recognized in another jurisdiction. First of all, can you go into deep explanation? Does this specifically, does jurisdiction need to be defined? And if not, who exactly is the jurisdiction? And is this impacting tribal court?
Mr. Clark, go ahead.
Representative Reinbold, through the chair. The best way to understand the actual mechanics of the bill are to read sections 5 and 6 first. And then the language you'll find inserted or deleted in other sections of the bill becomes clear. But I could step you through sections 5 and 6 if that would be helpful. And
so do we have to do that before you can answer the questions, that a lot of the things are being deleted, filed in court, and instead being recognized in another jurisdiction? So that's the first question I had.
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, that very simply accomplishes the main purpose of the bill, which is to eliminate the requirement for a protection order from another jurisdiction to be filed in an Alaskan court before enforcement can act on it.
Representative Reinbold?
With the indulgence of the chair, I don't know what the time limits are. If we have time to go through 5 and 6, so then other things would fall into place. It's up to you. It's the preference of the chair.
No, do it today, do it tomorrow. Go ahead.
Do you want to go ahead and go through 5 and 6 then, through the chair?
Certainly. Representative Reinbold, through the chair. Section 5 adds a new section to statute regarding the enforcement and recognition of protective orders issued in other jurisdictions that have to do with stalking or sexual assault, but without domestic violence. A protective order related to stalking or sexual assault issued by, quote, a court of the United States, a court of another state or territory, a United States military tribunal, or a tribal court, end quote, has the same effect and must be recognized and enforced in the same manner as a protective order issued by an Alaskan state court. The section also cites U.S. State Code Title 18, Chapter 2265, which is part of the Violence Against Women Act. That part addresses protection orders originating in other jurisdictions. Chapter 2265 expressly states that orders issued in other jurisdictions do not have to be filed in an Alaskan court in order to be enforced there. Chapter 2265 also describes certain criteria that we were just discussing. The issuing jurisdiction needs to meet in order for its protection order to be given full faith and credit by another jurisdiction. It further instructs law enforcement that stalking or sexual assault-related protection orders issued in another jurisdiction, an order that appears authentic on its face, should be presumed valid. Now, continue, through the chair, Representative Reinbold. Section 6 addresses protective orders relating to domestic violence. It amends the state statute, just as with protection orders relating to stalking and sexual assault in the absence of domestic violence. A protection order related to domestic violence issued in another jurisdiction must be recognized and enforced just as if it were issued by an Alaskan court, regardless of whether the protection order has been filed with an Alaskan court. It's similar to the section above, but in relation to situations where domestic violence has played a part. This also, it cites the Violence Against Women Act once again make sure that the issuing jurisdictions follow certain criteria, in order, for them to be given full faith and credit. So when you turn back to the other sections of the bill, what you'll see is that the changes made there are simply bringing those various sections into line with what has been established in Section 5 and 6 in terms of the registration requirements, in other words, or lack thereof in this case.
Mr. Chairman, can I?
Go ahead, Representative Reinbold.
My question was, does jurisdiction need to be defined, or is that clearly defined enough? It looks like it's clearly defined enough there. And how does this impact tribal law? Can you elaborate just a little bit?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, it does not necessarily impact tribal law or tribal courts. It could be construed as, say, a welcome further legitimization of a tribal court. But substantively, what it accomplishes is the simple removal of that requirement for the tribal court protection order to be registered with the state before enforcement can take place.
So
Representative
through the chair, so you said it increased the legitimization of the tribal courts. How are tribal courts funded?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, there are the ways that tribal courts are funded in according to my knowledge, are they vary to a considerable extent, and I wouldn't feel qualified to answer that question very thoroughly. I know that, for example...
Safe to say you're not an expert in trial courts as you join us today. Tribal courts, not trial courts.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I am certainly not an expert. I do know that, for example, the Civil Legal Services Corporation in Alaska does a lot of work helping tribal courts build their institutions and strengthen their institutions. I know that the Alaska court system itself is in greater and greater collaboration with tribal courts, undertaking the same activities in terms of building and fortifying their institutions. The degree to which that may be funded or otherwise, I'm not sure. I know that. But through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I'd hesitate to speak on it any further than that. So.
Representative Reinbold, I think it's fair to say he can't really answer your question. But yes. Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what I was going to reiterate. And could we have someone possibly before this bill moves that can give us a little bit more information about tribal court?
Sure, certainly not today. I
correct.
See Ms. Schroeder's here, and we've also got Ms. Lundquist on the line. If when we come back on Monday, we won't hear this bill till Monday. If when we come back, we could have somebody that might be able to give us a bit more insight about how tribal courts are funded, then I would say part of the question to answer is whether any of the funds from the state budget, whether it be in the court system or another part of the executive branch, is directing funds to tribal courts. I suspect Representative Reinbold would like to know that.
Yes, and more.
I'm sure. Okay. Any other follow-up questions today, Representative Reinbold? Okay. Representative Cobb.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So there is a very detailed memo that Attorney General Richards wrote that's included in the bill packet that answers 99.9% of the questions that have been asked today on reconciling VAWA with Alaska statute, and I would just encourage members to read that. It's dated July 30, 2015, and again, this issue simply makes it so orders from other states, territories, and non-Alaska tribes to protect people can be enforced here. And that's all it does. And a protection order is not an arrest warrant. It just protects people, and it allows an Alaska officer to arrest if a protection order is violated. And as Mr. Clark did point out, due process is required for those orders to be issued to be valid. The hard part from the law enforcement officer's perspective, and Mr. Chair, from my experience, is if they're not in the registry, it is hard because different formats are used in many different jurisdictions. So I think everything we do to encourage as much registration of these orders in the Central Alaska Public Safety Information Network registry makes it easier on the officers knowing that it's a valid order. But again, the AG's memo is very well written and explains exactly what we're doing here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I see we're almost up to 3:15. I'll get the clock straight. Anybody have any follow-up questions at this point for Mr. Clark? I don't think we'll go to any other witnesses today. I will note, just as kind of a concurring with Representative Cobb's observations, I think what Congress made a decision to do and what we're incorporating so that we can be in compliance with federal law is that in terms of protecting people women particularly that have been subject to domestic violence, we want to err on the side of protection. And I think to some extent what Representative Kopp is talking about is this reality that somebody comes to the police station and hands them a piece of paper that appears to be a duly enacted court order that says certain things, and we've all heard stories about all the things you can do with a copy machine and a computer with PDFs and all kinds of things, and so one appears what appears to be a valid protection order and hands it to the police officer and says enforce this, and the police officer under these federal rules as well as this law would be expected to follow that order even though they lack the ability to confirm that this is in fact a registered order. And the purpose of registering the order was to give a police officer some degree of confidence, and we're making a policy decision to provide greater protection than that allows, and I think there are very good reasons for providing that protection. So but these are the questions that I think we're discussing. So what I will go ahead and do, I think everyone has had a chance to sign the sheet for the resolution that has moved, and we're going to go ahead and adjourn now. At this time, we will continue this hearing on Monday. If you have amendments to HB 8 and you know about them, please submit them to my office by 5 o'clock on Friday. It remains my hope to move this out of the committee on Monday, but if we have a lot more to discuss, I'm not firmly committed to keeping it on that Monday schedule. I will remind members that this committee will not be meeting this Friday, February 10th, and we will stand adjourned at 3:15 p.m.